Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Jeffrey Swartz. I'm a professor of law at Cooley Law School's Tampa Bay campus, together with my compatriot and colleague, Brendan Berry, who is also a professor of law at Cooley's Tampa Bay campus. And with us, as always, is our mentor and all-around good guy, Ezzy Harris. So good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay. I have to say this, our disclaimer every week, and that is that everything that Brendan and I talk about are not necessarily the opinions of the administration of Cooley Law School, its faculty, either at large or individually.
Mm-hmm.
And we are here again with the Constitution today and everything else we want to talk about. And we're actually going to talk about some stuff in front of SCOTUS sometime during this hour. But we are going to start out with the newest thing that we've been talking about, and is that's the moron of the week. Today our moron is a group. It is a group. They're known as the Republican Conference in the United States House of Representatives. And together, okay, they are just, I say so for one simple reason today, that sometime during this day, people believe, unless the 10 to 12 or 14 holdouts continue to hold out against the absolute badgering and bullying of the prospective speaker, the person known as Jacketless Jim Jordan, Jim Jordan will become the Speaker of the House. And for the first time in our history, this moronic group of people will place the gavel of the House of Representatives in the hands of a man who does not believe in the Constitution. They will put it in the hands of a man who is nothing short of a bully, an insurrectionist, a person who tolerates and does not protect the athletes who are in his charge from the molestations that are created, that were performed on them by another coach who has been disowned by my alma mater, The Ohio State University. And my belief is that no one is calling out the fact that he has orchestrated all of this chaos. And he has orchestrated the ability to become the Speaker of the House, knowing that in the original election, he could not beat McCarthy and he could not become the Speaker. So he made friends with McCarthy and then did everything he could behind the scenes to undercut McCarthy's authority, finally sending his lapdog, Matt Gaetz, in to destroy McCarthy's speakership, and then made himself the first declared candidate to replace McCarthy. This was all done in an orchestrated way for an insurrectionist, an election denier, an anti-constitutionalist to become the Speaker of the House. This is going to be a horrible year and a half. Just get ready for it. There will be a shutdown. The government will shut down in about 30 days. I have absolutely no doubts. Because Jordan is a bully, and he thinks he can bully Joe Biden. He thinks he can bully everybody. He'll just take off his jacket, roll up his sleeves, pull his tie down, and say, I'm tougher than you are. And you know what they say about a bully. The best way to get rid of him is to give him a proverbial punch in the nose. And his punch in the nose will come next November when Democrats take at least 30 seats, maybe even 40, away from Republicans and drive Jim Jordan down into the depths of ignominy as a Speaker of the House. Nothing he wants to do will get done because he cannot bully McConnell and he cannot bully Biden. So nothing he wants is going to happen. And the only thing, result he can do is to shut down the government, and it will be the Jim Jordan shutdown, and it will kill every single Republican who got elected in a Biden district. They're done. They're over. Unless they abandon him and get together with Democrats. So, Republicans in the House, you are today's collective moron of the day.
Yeah.
There you go.
Right.
But I don't really have any strong feelings about this at all.
No, no, right. That's
sounds like a short and sweet epitaph.
Yeah, we can only hope. That's I don't know what to say anymore. I mean, you know, it's interesting. Apparently, at Fox and Friends, I saw a headline, and then I read a little bit of the article, and of course, it's not what I originally thought. On
you really
Fox
thought
and
it was
going to
be something like you could read and really like? Go ahead.
Oh no, I didn't think I'd like it, but I thought it was interesting, and here's why: because the headline says, you know, Fox and Friends calls Republicans, quote unquote, a carnival of idiots. And so, so I was like, wow, even on Fox, you know, they're referring to this. And then I dug in a little bit and said, oh, that's what this is about. See, I thought that maybe when they said carnival of idiots, they were talking about Jim, you know, GYM, Jordan.
Shower Jim.
Yeah. Right. Oh God. But, you know, cause you'd think, I mean, you know, when you say carnival of idiots, you know, the first names that come to mind are, you know, Jim Jordan, Scalise, McCarthy, you know, of course, some Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert, you know, we've been through this list before. There's what we're calling the clown car. But no, you know what Fox and Friends was mad about? They weren't talking about those people as the carnival of idiots. They were talking about the moderate Republicans, quote unquote, you know, to the extent there is any moderate left in the Republican Party, but the self-styled moderate Republicans who are holding out against Jim Jordan, that's who they're referring to as idiots. That a Republican who would stand in the way of Jim Jordan is an idiot, according to these people. That's how far this whole thing has devolved. I mean,
and that's
you look at Jim Jordan.
That's why I still think that he created all of this, that he was behind it all to begin with.
Right, right. Yeah, because we've got Hannity behind him. He's got the Fox News machine behind him. I don't know how many times we can go over this. You look at how far the Republican Party has fallen, and you constantly say to yourself, it can't get worse than this. And then the next thing you know, the Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, for oh my God, I can't even believe we'd have to say that, is this guy Jim Jordan. Next in line to the presidency of the United States after the vice president. And you look at the character of this person, the behavior of this person, you know, and add him to the list. You know, Donald Trump and all the rest. And we have, you know, there's this movie called Idiocracy. I don't know if you both ever saw that movie. And it portrays a future where some guy of average intelligence is somehow transported into the future to discover that in the intervening years between, you know, his original date and the future, the world and the United States in particular has devolved into what the movie is called, which is Idiocracy, where people have not gotten smarter. They've gotten dumber exponentially. And the president of the United States is a professional wrestler. right, with a fondness for firing off machine guns inside the residence, right? This level of ridiculousness. And I remember this movie was, I don't know, a couple decades ago, I think that movie was out. And I did watch it, and, you know, you mildly entertained by it, not realizing that I was watching a documentary.
Yeah.
Right? That this is going to come true.
Driving you
here we are
to talk about education. You want me to do that? I'll be more than happy to.
No, that's all right.
No, I didn't think so.
That's all right.
I didn't think so.
Oh, God. Well, it's
I
not
told
because
you
it's
that's
not even.
Example.
Well, that's one of them, but it's not even just that. It's powers of perception, right? I mean, there are plenty of people in our generation who are voting for this nonsense too. And it's like, you know, you look at, and again, I'm not one of these people who, you know, wants to be, you know, body shaming or judging people on how they look, but people make decisions about how to present themselves to the world. And there are people who, you know, just by the way they present themselves are abjectly ridiculous human beings. I grew up in New York, where you are, Hezzy. And every time, you know, I grew up on Long Island, about 50 miles east of the city. But we'd go into Manhattan on a regular basis, you know, me and friends and family. And I think every time I went into Manhattan as a youngster, we went into Trump Tower. And, you know, took a look around, you know, the pink marble and all this and the waterfall in there and all that stuff. I know well the escalator, you know, where he came down to announce his presidency. But when we went into Trump Tower, or you know, and we were, you know, walking around there and taking it all in, everybody that I'm aware of, everybody certainly in my orbit, considered Donald Trump to be an absolute clown because he already had the hair thing going back then.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody knew.
He always had the hair
issue. Yeah, the hair thing going on, and everybody knew that he was a clown and a wannabe. Everybody knew that he would, you know, that he was planting his own stories and tabloids. Everybody knew this. And you know, Jim Jordan, the way he presents himself to the world, Donald Trump, the way he presents himself to the world, with the painted on orange face and all the rest of it. I mean, this, it's not just that we have an education problem. It's that people can't look at somebody who is abjectly, as I've said, ridiculous, and see it for what it is. And I can't understand it.
Well, Jim and Tammy Faye Baker had a big following too,
so, you know.
You know, the more ridiculous you think your life is, the more you like someone who looks as ridiculous as you.
Yeah, right.
How's that?
Right. Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
That's the way it comes down.
Mm-hmm.
There's a couple of matters. This makes me angry, but I've calmed down over this. But every time I hear it, it kind of, I have to go take a blood pressure pill. There has been a great deal of talk about American Palestinians, people who have Palestinian roots, and/or Palestinian students who are here from Palestine, are Palestinian, voicing their displeasure over the reaction of Israel and their approval of the acts of Hamas. And they are free, and I will say what our forefathers, many of them, said. I may not agree with what you have to say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it, and that's fine. But if you're going to stand up and say things, you don't do it in anonymity. That's why, for example, the New York Times, other than a very rare occasion, has ever published an op-ed or a letter that's sent to them by someone who claims anonymity. You say it, you own it. And the reason why I raised that is because the first thing that they constantly, either purposely or because they just don't care about the history of 70 years ago, is that somehow Israelis threw Palestinians out of what was then Palestine. I went through this last week. I will do it in brief today. That is patently untrue. If the Palestinians should be angry at anyone, it is the Arab countries that told them to fight, that told them to leave, that told them to say no to a partitioning which would have given them their homeland and the Jews their homeland, and under a UN resolution, as the British left. Those are the ones to blame. They have been used and abused. They are looked down upon by other Arab countries. They don't want them. They consider Palestinians lazy, smelly, sheep herders who just want a handout. So when they left and the Arab countries lost the war to drive Israel and Jews into the sea, and Israel said, well, if you don't want this part of the country, we'll take it, and then put all of these Palestinians into these refugee camps and allowed them to breed, kept them locked up in refugee camps, did not allow them into their societies. They are to blame for your lot in life. And they allow you to continue to harass Israel, but they don't really back you. You are just a tool of harassment. That's all you are. And the sooner you learn this, and the sooner you accept it, the sooner things will get better. But you don't want to accept it. You're not getting help. You're getting just enough to make you think you're making a difference, but you're not. And the differences that you have made you more and more a burden to other people. Egypt won't even let you into Sinai. It's a frigging desert. But they don't want you there. They don't want you seeping into their society. They don't want you to become a burden for them any more than the Syrians want you, any more than the Iranians want you, any more than the Iraqis want you, or the Turks, or the Lebanese. They don't want you. They just want you to suffer and stay angry. But don't go around telling everybody that Israel's responsible for your lot in life. Nobody told you or Hamas to kill 1,400 Jews in one day, to chop off the heads of children, to shoot them in their cribs, to rape women and then kidnap them, and then sit around and laugh about it for hours. No one told you to do that. You decided to do that. And now you don't want to pay the price for it, the price you knew you were going to have to pay. And you're going to pay. The cost kidnap people and hostages is going to be large. I said this last week, and I'm going to say it again. In the end, there will be collateral damage. I know that's what the families don't want to hear, but you must face this reality. To destroy Hamas, you have got to collapse all the tunnels. That means there are people down there that are going to be buried alive. That's just the only way. So that's what's going to happen. That's why these tunnels are all underneath hospitals and schools and homes, because they use the people above as human shields against, you know, bunker busting bombs. Everybody down there, unfortunately, is going to die. That's the goal. And if we lose those 200, that is a calculation that the government of Israel has already made. And it's sad to say, but that's the way it is. You go into a campus like Harvard or two campuses in California or others, and you write letters demanding that the university condemn Israel, and you put the name of 34 student groups, and you, the president of Harvard, condemn their approval of terrorism, you don't do it, do you? You sit there and you play games. Freedom of speech. Nobody said they couldn't speak. But nobody said you had to approve that speech. We're not talking about throwing them out of school. It is unfathomable that Harvard would not disassociate the university and condemn the statement in the letter that was written. Fathomable to me that you sit there and talk about First Amendment rights. That's fine. They have the right to say it. But when CEOs around this country say, I not only want to know the names of the groups, I want to know the people that are in those groups that approved this. I'm Jewish. I don't want them walking in my door. I'm not going to hire them. Other corporations see no profit in hiring them. And then they will yell and scream that there is a bias and a prejudice against them. Well, kids, you created it. You thought you could do this and everything would be fine. You're going to go out and make your six-figure salary because you're from Harvard. Well, guess what? There's a job waiting for you at Wendy's. You have a First Amendment right. I'm not telling you you can't say those things. I disagree with them. I think they're stupid. I think they lack truth. But the truth of the matter is, you don't have a right to say what you want to say and then say, I don't have to stand, I can't be held accountable for it. Everything you say publicly, everything I say here, if I say something that offends people, I pay the price. You have to pay the price. This has cost Harvard alone millions, tens of millions of dollars, the least of which is the Wexners, the Wexner Foundation, an organization that was created by Leslie Wexner and his wife Abigail to promote the growth of Israelis, okay, at Harvard. Another Israeli billionaire by the name of Idan Ofer and his wife Fatia have quit the board, the executive board of Harvard, over all of this, which they have a right to do, yet they're being criticized for pulling their money. This is where you stand up and you tell us who you are. And Harvard does not have to approve. They may have to let them say it, but they don't have to approve people who excuse and or celebrate and or blame violence on others as being the responsibility of the others. And this has to come to an end. You do not control your university. Write all the letters you want. Take credit for them and suffer the consequences for them. Otherwise, shut your yap and stop writing and do what you're supposed to do. Study and learn. But I don't have any strong feelings about that.
Not that or about anything, really. You really need to work on developing your passion, you know.
I really do.
Yeah.
I really do.
Yeah. You make two points that are worth emphasizing. One,
the rest
is,
of it wasn't worth it.
Well, the whole thing was. The whole thing was worth it. You know. But I wanna put an exclamation point on two points.
I'll do that. Thank you.
All right. and the first is that you touched on is this concept of freedom of speech that people have that is just widely misunderstood. You can go ahead and say it. Harvard's not going to stop them from saying it. And to clarify, what they said was that Israel, which they refer to as an apartheid regime, is solely responsible for what happened. That's what they said. Which would be something like saying that that the United States was solely responsible for what happened to it on 9/11. I realize these people around the world have their grievances against the United States and against Israel, much of which, as you say, is misplaced. Having your grievances and acting out in a way that terrorists do are two different things. And you can't blame acts of terror on the victim of the terror. And you can't indulge in false equivalents and say that what the Israelis are doing, in Gaza is the same thing that Hamas did in Israel. No. No, because Israel, are children going to die in Gaza? They are. Are the Israelis trying to kill children in Gaza? No, they're not. And anybody who can't distinguish between those things needs to go back to reasoning school. Okay, Hamas went into Israel with the intent to kill children and to rape women and to kidnap people. That was their intent going in. Israel is going into Gaza with the intent to destroy Hamas, not to kill children and not to rape women. That doesn't mean that women and children aren't going to die, because they are. That's how war is. Now back to my point, as we sometimes get sidetracked here. So these people said that Israel is the one that's responsible for this. What the First Amendment provides, right, which is what we're talking about when we say freedom of speech, is that the government may not stop you from speaking or punish you for what you've said, except under narrow circumstances, of course. And so these people have been afforded their freedom of speech. People have common misunderstandings about freedom of speech. One is that private parties can violate your freedom of speech, right? A corporation can violate your freedom of speech, or a private university for that matter. And that is not true. We can make our own decisions as private individuals if we want to tolerate other people's speech, but we also have our own First Amendment rights. And that includes the right to express our own thoughts and opinions and to disassociate ourselves from certain offensive ideas. So if a corporate CEO wants to know who you are when you were ignorant enough to sign something that said that Israel was responsible for what happened to it. If a CEO wants to know who you are and wants to make sure that you don't work for them, that's their First Amendment right. And so you can't complain about that as a violation of freedom of speech. The other point you talked about was they're going to claim that there's bias against them. This is like Donald Trump does this all the time. Anybody who doesn't like or who opposes Donald Trump, he says they hate Trump. They're biased against Trump.
Yeah, but he may be right about that.
Well, except that he's not. He might be right about the hate Trump part, right?
Well, that's where what I mean. I'm not talking about, they're violating his First Amendment right. I'm just saying he may be right. You have to understand it isn't paranoia when the whole world really is against you, okay?
Well, yeah. And it also might be you, right? It also might be you
exactly.
when the whole world is against you, right? And that's my point, is that hating somebody doesn't mean you're biased against them. Those mm-hmm. things are commonly conflated.
Construed.
Conflated.
Do I harbor animus toward Donald Trump? You bet I do. Am I biased against Donald Trump? Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Huh?
No. Bias means I prejudged. Right. Bias means that I had some prejudged a notion of Donald Trump, and I wasn't fair.
Oh, I get it.
And reaching
so you're not
a judgment
really biased.
About him.
You've judged him.
Yeah. And correctly.
Okay, I can accept that. Right? Okay. I just
yeah, based
sure
on his behavior,
correctly.
His conduct.
Yeah.
Then
okay,
the criminal justice system does this all the time. You know, a jury is going to say that you're guilty. That doesn't mean they're biased. It means they listen to the evidence and reached a conclusion.
And after hearing the evidence, they may actually hate you, but that doesn't mean they're biased.
And that's right. That's right. That's right. You know, I really think we got to get over this. This is a distinction I think is important, that every time somebody opposes one of these clowns, they're accused of being biased against them. Nobody's biased against Jim Jordan or against Donald Trump. This isn't bias. It's listening to the words that are coming out of your mouth and knowing that you're a clown.
I understand the difference. I've been educated today.
Okay, there you go, you know.
I've been
you're very pro-education, so I just wanted to help.
Yep. I've been edumacated.
There you go. Right.
I now understand the difference. We're going to talk about the First Amendment, and we're going to get to – because there's more on the First Amendment for today. I think you might know where we're going. But I'm going to start out with something as a preface. This morning I was watching Morning Joe like I always do before I left for my walk at 6:30 in the morning and listened to it. And there was a guy named Chuck Rosenberg, a guy who I have a great deal of respect for. He's a very smart, soft-spoken lawyer, former U.S. attorney, and a pretty good litigator in his day. And I've listened to his podcast a couple of times, and he really kind of puts things into perspective sometimes. Today, I will tell you he is 100% wrong with what he talked about. Before I even started to tell you, he's 100% wrong. Chuck was a litigator. He was a prosecutor. I'm going to tell you now, as a former judge, how I feel about something. And I'm going to tell you that I had an experience that led me to the precipice of where Chunkin is now, or is putting herself and putting her target. And let's just face it, he is a target. Chuck got on and said, the gag order is great. It's what she had to do. But the problem is enforcement. I just don't think she can ever put Trump in jail. Well, I'm going to tell you right now, she doesn't have a choice but to put him in jail.
Mm-hmm.
She can't punish him by moving the trial up. It's too short a period of time now anyway. It's only 3 months until 4 months until the trial anyway. She cannot warn him again because she's already warned him once and now she's entering an order. How many warnings do you get? She cannot treat him differently than she would any other defendant. I'm sorry. He is a defendant in a criminal case, and yes, he has the right of political speech, but he does not have the right to defy a judge's order. Now, just briefly, not long before my third election candidacy, I had an insurance company. I was doing some civil work, and I had an insurance company step in front of me, and I ordered them to produce certain discovery and even told them how they could do it. And immediately the young lawyer who was there said, I have been told to tell you, Judge, we're not going to do that. I said, are you telling me you can't do it or that you won't? I've been told to tell you we won't. I said, okay, are you telling me that you're going to appeal my order? No, your order is probably correct, but we're just not going to do it. So my immediate response was, who do I address the rule to show cause to? And they named their corporate counsel. I'm going to use his name because it's true. His name was Chuck Grimsley. And so I said, okay, will you accept service for Mr. Grimsley? Yes, I'll accept service. And so I drafted, I said, you wait, we're going to draft it, and I'm going to hand it to you. And I drafted a show cause order, and I gave it to her. I said, now Mr. Grimsley has been served, and I made it part of the record. I said, I want him in front of me. I think this was on Tuesday. This was like on one Thursday. I said, okay, I want him here on Tuesday. Grimsley shows up, and I went through the I reminded him of why he was, the show cause order was issued, and I said, are you prepared to comply with my order? And there was a courtroom full of people, and I did it on purpose. I wanted a courtroom full of people to either see him bend the knee or defy.
Mm-hmm.
And he openly defied me in front of a courtroom full of lawyers and litigants. He just openly defied me and said, we're not going to do it, Judge. We're refusing.
Wow.
I said, you're not appealing? No, we're not appealing. No one's saying your order isn't lawful, Judge. We just don't want to do it, so we're not going to. I said, Mr. Grimsley, you have until Friday at 9 o'clock to produce the discovery. And you will do it in open court. I will be downtown handling another judge's calendar. Be there at 9 o'clock Friday with the discovery. Or bring your toothbrush. For the next 3 days, he was on the phone, calling every judge who would take his call. They stopped taking his call because it got around what he was calling about. But he talked to a number of judges, both in my county and Broward County. And he said, is he really going to put me in jail? And the answer was unanimously, yes, he will. He's not afraid. And you defied him in open court. What do you expect him to do? So Friday morning at 10 minutes to 9, I get a phone call. My judicial assistant took it. She came in. She said, it was Mr. Grimsley. He's stuck in traffic. He's going to be about 10 minutes late. And I said, tell him I'm here all day. He showed up about a quarter after 9. He had a tie very loosely around his neck. He did not have any cufflinks on. He was wearing no jewelry, not even a watch. He was wearing loafers. I think he still had a belt on, but I didn't really pay that much attention. And he was sweating bullets. Why? Because he was about to hear a jail cell door close behind him. And he knew it. And I was prepared to do it. I wasn't nervous about it. I just knew what I had to do. I had court officers there ready to take him. And he saw them. I had 2 or 3 court officers in the courtroom. So he knew I meant business. He was going to be escorted out and booked into the Dade County Jail. And he just said, Judge, I have 1/3 of the discovery. I said, well, that's a good start. I said, how long will it take you to get the rest? He said, 2 weeks. I knew he could get it in a matter of a couple of days. And I said, that's fine. I'm going to give you 30 days. So there's no excuses at the end for noncompliance. This hearing is reset for 30 days from now unless plaintiff's counsel notifies me they've gotten all the discovery, at which point I will set aside the rule to show cause. He walked very slowly out of the courtroom. I mean, his knees had to be weak. This is what will happen to Donald Trump. I disagree with Chuck Rosenberg. You can put Donald Trump in jail. And his security will just have to do 8-hour shifts sitting in front of his cell. And if you want to see a grown man cry, the first time this guy hears a jail cell clink behind him, he will break down in tears like nothing you've ever seen. Because to his father, this would be making him the biggest loser of all. Going to jail. There is no other remedy if he defies Judge Chunkin's order. She has to put him in jail. Nothing else will hurt him. Warnings, yelling at him, he doesn't give a flying crap about any of that. Money? Sure. What are you going to fine him? $100 million? That might hurt. But the court would never uphold it. You put him in jail, and you say 2 days, and I'm not staying the sentence pending appeal. You can get the D.C. Circuit to get him out. You go ahead and go over there and get them to get him out. Otherwise, I've done what I'm supposed to do. He's in jail for 2 days. That's all it'll take. And if he does it again, it'll be a week. And if he does it again, you revoke his bond, you put him in jail, and you keep him there until his trial's over. And you make it abundantly clear that that's the progression. I disagree with you, Chuck Rosenberg, vehemently. This is not hard. This is not rocket science. This is Judge 101. Now we can talk about the gag order. Go to it, Brendan.
Well, yeah, and I wanted to talk about his statement after the gag order. We've talked before about, I always find it remarkable listening to Donald Trump. You know, one of the conditions that's obvious, you know, as far as Donald Trump is malignant narcissism. And we've talked about this a lot too. You know, most of us have experience dealing with somebody, right, in our orbit. In my case, there's quite a few in my family who definitely fit the bill of malignant narcissists. And when you read about it and study it, and which I have, so I don't have any kind of a formal degree in it, but I've studied it. There's a broad consensus that one of the causes of malignant narcissism is some kind of trauma or at least neglect in young childhood, where a person is not experiencing love typically from their parents or anyone else, and learns to provide that for themselves, self-love, and it gets out of control. The hallmarks of a malignant narcissist would be emotional immaturity, because your emotional growth is stunted at a very young age. You are essentially a shell of a person, because you're ashamed of the real you and scared of the real you, but the only thing that's important to you is how other people see you. You need their adoration, and you need their at least their attention, if not their love. And when you listen to Donald Trump talk, you realize how emotionally stunted he is. uses the literally uses the language of a toddler when he speaks. I've said it, you know, before when the three of us are talking, you listen to the way Donald Trump talks about other people, and he'll say things like, "She wasn't. I don't like her. She wasn't nice to me."
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the type. There is no. There are no multisyllabic words. There are no complicated thought processes. There are no reasoned explanations. He is an emotional 8-year-old. And so here's what he said after the judge imposed the gag order. This is a quote. "They're getting very beaten very badly by me in the polls, whoever they are. They think the only way they can catch me is to stop me from speaking. They want to take away my voice, and a judge gave a gag order today." Just listen to that construction of that sentence. The judge gave a gag order. Judges don't give orders. Judges issue orders. They impose. Right. But again, the language of a child. Yeah, enter, right. But the language of a child, right? The judge mm-hmm. gave a gag order. "Did you hear that?" This is him again. "On speech, which I believe is totally unconstitutional, what she did. A judge gave a gag order. A judge doesn't like me too much. Her whole life is not liking me, but she gave a gag order. You know what a gag order is? You can't speak badly. But this is weaponry, all being done because Joe Biden is losing. And he's very, very, very badly.
Oh, stop.
He's losing badly.
Please stop. Please
yeah,
stop.
This is a direct quote from Donald Trump.
I'm getting dumber by the second. You're dumbing
yeah,
me down.
The guy,
don't do that.
He is a 4-year-old. I said 8 years old before. I'm sorry. I misspoke. There's something, again, and people are persuaded by this. They're clapping and cheering.
Why does it resonate with people? Is their language that poor?
He speaks that language. He speaks their language. He talks like they do.
Mm-hmm.
They understand him. It's like when you go to France every once in a while, well, maybe once every third word, you can understand what they're saying to you. Okay? Mm-hmm. It literally is like a foreign language. It's a, you know, we used to complain many years ago that African Americans spoke in what was known as Ebonics. Remember that?
Yeah, I remember.
Brendan, remember Ebonics? Their own street language, okay? And I know that they don't like that word, but that's the way it was, that's how it was described. And this is Trump's Ebonics, okay? This is how he speaks to the crowd because this crowd can understand a 4-word sentence. They cannot understand a nuanced sentence. And so he speaks that way on purpose. This is not – he does know how to string at least 7 or 8 words together, sometimes cogently. But that's why they listen to him, does he? He talks like they do. He speaks in 4 or 5-word sentences. And I'm firmly convinced of that. And again, I'm not going to start on the education in America. I'm not going to do that today, okay? But it does come down to that, okay? You know, I can talk about that every single week if you want me to. But, you know, that's kind of the way they do it. Let's talk about this gag order for a minute, okay? First of all, I want to stress something. Donald Trump said, "I'm willing to go to jail."
Mm-hmm.
To protect the Constitution. Well, keep it up, and we're going to grant your wish. This is like, Marilyn, are you listening? Telling a police officer, go ahead and arrest me.
Yeah.
Please arrest me. Because you know what they'll do? They'll grant your wish. It may not last long, but they will put handcuffs on you and march you out of wherever you are, whether it's an auditorium or an airplane. It doesn't matter. They will do that. This gag order, he declared as being unconstitutional. Well, not according to the Fifth Circuit. And I don't normally cite cases, but I'm going to cite it anyway. United States versus James Harvey Brown, also known as Jim Brown. It was a state official charged with various offenses related to brokering of sham settlements of state's threatened lawsuit against the president of a failed insurance company, and he moved to vacate or modify a gag order generally prohibiting attorneys, parties, and witnesses from discussing the case with any public communications media. And in this case, the Fifth Circuit made certain findings. First of all, the district court has the right to enter an order, and that order denying a defendant's motion to vacate or modify a gag order was not appealable under statutes authorizing appeals from interlocutory orders. This order is not appealable because trial courts, according to the Fifth Circuit, have an affirmative constitutional duty to minimize the effects of prejudicial pretrial publicity. And beneficiaries of that duty include not only the defendant in a given trial, but other defendants as well, such as co-defendants in the same case or defendants in related cases whose fair trial rights might be prejudiced. An order by a federal court that relates only to the conduct or progress of litigation before that court ordinarily is not considered an injunction and therefore is not appealable under statute authorizing appeals from interlocutory orders. The criminal's right to a fair trial may not be compromised by commentary from any lawyer or party offered up for media consumption on the courthouse steps. A prior restraint will generally be upheld only if the government can establish that the activity restrained poses either a clear and present danger or a serious and imminent threat to a protected competing interest. That is, the government must establish that the order has been narrowly drawn and is the least restrictive means available. This is exactly what Chunkin said she was going to do. The trial court may impose a gag order on trial participants if the court determines that there is a substantial likelihood that extrajudicial commentary by trial participants will undermine a fair trial, so long as the order is also narrowly tailored and the least restrictive means available and standard. The standard applies to both lawyers and parties, at least where the court's overriding interest is in preserving a fair trial. And the government is as entitled to a fair trial as the defendant is. You're wrong, Donald, again, as usual, as always, when it comes to the Constitution. She said, I'm narrowly tailoring this. Certain types of this, certain things you're allowed to say, certain things you're not allowed to say. He's going to violate this order. Mark my, I mean, I'm telling you, I will eat every hat I own if he doesn't. And I go back to what I said at the beginning of this discussion. She has no choice to lock him up. Let him go through the booking process. Let him go through the delousing process. Let him put on an orange jumpsuit and let the doors close behind him. Ka-coink. And he will cry like a baby. Let him get a taste of jail. Things might get better if he realizes he's going to go to jail, and he's going to go to jail for a longer period of time if he violates again. And let him understand when you're found guilty, you're going to go to jail. You're going to get your bond revoked, and you're going to jail. There will be no supersedious bond for you. And once he understands that, life changes. And by the way, loose cannon can't protect you. First Amendment. What do you think, Brendan?
Oh, God. No. There's no question he's going to violate it. I mean, he almost, he went right up to the line at least by attacking the judge again after she imposed it in the first place. I agree.
If Loro's any kind of lawyer, he's going to go back and say, I had a fine time with Judge Chunkin. We laughed.
Mm-hmm.
We told jokes to each other.
She laughed.
It was very light. It's true. It was lighthearted. Right. Okay.
Uh-huh.
But listen to me very carefully, Donald. She means business. If you're willing to go to jail, then say the things you've been saying before. Violate the order. And when you show up for a hearing, make sure you're wearing loafers. Take off your belt. I know your pants will fall down. Take off your belt. Take off your tie. Take off your watch. Okay? And bring your toothbrush. Now,
is this all part of his shtick? Is this part of his shtick? Like he wants to run the show, even though he's got lawyers. He doesn't listen to them.
He is challenging. He is pushing every single envelope, okay? Mm. And Chunkin is the wrong person to challenge. And the lawyer and the judge in New York was the wrong person to challenge. He's been gagged twice now.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you something. He does not want to violate the judge in New York, because if he decides to put him in jail as punishment, he goes to Rikers Island. He doesn't go to the federal Metropolitan Detention Center, which is a jail too. He goes to Rikers Island. Can you imagine Donald Trump in Rikers Island?
No.
That'd be interesting. He's going to need that security. So Brendan, I think you heard Chuck Rosenberg this morning too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He was wrong. All wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny when you said this morning that you're going to disagree with Chuck Rosenberg, I laughed and said, yep, I saw it too.
Yep. You did. You knew exactly what I was going to say. Before we get off, there were a number of cases that I want to talk about. But we don't have time. And one of them that was decided is, all you Second Amendment nuts, you lost one in front of the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll tell you all about it next week, but you lost one. And it was a big one. And it is it portends a lot of other matters relating to the Second Amendment, not going the way you think they're going to go.
Mm-hmm.
And some other cases that came down of some import. And lastly, as far as I'm concerned, last thing I want to say is that tomorrow Joe Biden is going to the Middle East. And at other times, for example, when he went to Ukraine, messages went to the Russians. Air Force One is flying into Ukraine. Joe, even if lightning hits that plane, it's going to be your fault. Do you understand? I don't think Hamas or Hezbollah are going to think like the Russians and think in those terms. So he will be escorted by fighters, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But it's a very brave thing for him to fly into Tel Aviv tomorrow.
Yeah.
Godspeed, and God protect you. It's that simple. It's a very brave thing he's about to do. The Russians we could control. Hamas and Hezbollah, not so much. Or the Iranians, not so much. So I wish him Godspeed on his trip and success.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yep. And just in case anybody has any nefarious thoughts, they might want to look at the two United States Navy aircraft carrier strike force groups parked off their coast.
You have no idea the destructive power of one of those strike forces.
Right.
One of those task forces. It is basically able to destroy just about any country in the world from the decks of all of those vessels.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine what two of them can do. That's basically the whole Russian Air Force on two carriers.
Right.
And I can guarantee you there are going to be AWACS up there. Those are those radar airplanes. If they see anything take off headed west from Iran, there will be 20 fighters up there ready to greet them wherever they go. And they will last about 30 seconds. That's assuming that the Israelis get to them first, because if the Israelis get to them first, they'll only last 15 seconds. Because they're the best pilots in the world. The best. So, Iran, I would put everything you've got, turn off the engines and put them back in their hangars. And if I were Hezbollah, I would put those surface-to-air missiles away, too. But Godspeed to our president.
Yeah, yeah.
Truthfully. He goes to Jordan after that.
Mm-hmm.
To meet with the Egyptians. And we'll see. Even the Egyptians aren't brave enough to fly into Israel. They won't go there. But Biden's going. So, good luck.
Indeed.
Anything else, Brendan, before we...
Nope, that's the note I was going to end on, too. So.
Okay. All right.
Thanks, Hezzy.
Thank you, Hezzy.
Gentlemen.
Thank you, everybody, for listening
Always
to us.
Always a pleasure.
We will talk to you all next week. Hezzy, take care of yourself, as always, please.
All the best, guys.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
Okay. Take care,
okay.
Hezzy. Talk to you later.
Enjoy the
yep.
day.
Bye.
Have a great week.
Be well.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
There we have it, folks. None other than Brendan Beery, Jeffrey Swartz, both professors at Cooley Law School based in the Tampa campus in Florida. Well, let's look and see what else is going on, which is really quite interesting. Don't hear this too much about these people, but they're definitely there. Israel's Negev Bedouins are the forgotten victims of the Hamas attack and as a rally to provide aid. The victims of the October 7 Hamas attack include at least 19 members of the Negev Bedouin Arab community, now both civilians and members of Israeli armed forces. The loss has prompted community volunteers to provide aid to a minority that has often suffered state discrimination, as well as calls for a return to peace negotiations to end the deadly cycle of violence. Well, Mazen Abu Siam's face furrows with worry lines as he recalls the October 7 Hamas attack on Israel and its deadly toll on his community. Fortunately, it happened on a Saturday, the Sabbath. If the attack happened during the week, there would have been more Bedouin victims in the kibbutz perhaps even dozens, and this is unprecedented in our history, explained Siam. The Hamas attack inflicted a heavy toll on the Negev Bedouin Arabs, an ancient, traditionally pastoralist, nomadic people now settled mostly in Israel's southern Negev desert. 12 members of Siam's community were killed, 7 are currently being held hostage, and dozens more were injured in Saturday's attack. The first rocket fired by Hamas fell here in Hula. It killed a 5-year-old boy. Another killed 4 children 2 kilometers away, wounding the rest of the family. The third killed a woman and her grandmother, says Siam, reclining on embroidered cushions in a Bedouin tent propped by a modern metal structure seemingly at odds with the traditional interior. His quiet recounting of death and nostalgic and hostage tolls is suddenly cut short by the deafening roar of an F-16 fighter jet overhead. The veterinarian and Bedouin activist, who is also a member of the municipal council of the nearby town of Rahat, population of about 80,000, barely raises an eyebrow. The Gaza Strip is barely 40 kilometers away. He's grown accustomed to the sounds of war. Well, the Negev Bedouins were equally vulnerable to the Hamas attack, according to Siam. Quote, these people were living in makeshift houses. They have no shelter to protect themselves, nowhere to run. Unlike our towns, they have no sirens to alert them when rockets are fired, so they don't even know that an attack is taking place, he explains. Israel's Negev Bedouin Arabs have long suffered state discrimination, according to human rights groups. Since the 1970s, they have been pushed out of and denied access to their pastoral lands and crammed into settlements, many of which are officially, quote, unrecognized, and end quote, and subject to evictions, unlike those built by Jewish citizens, according to the Human Rights Watch. Well, many of the illegal settlements, which are built with whatever materials are at hand, do not have access to running water or electricity. Residents rely on solar energy in the absence of state-provided electricity. Quote, Bedouins are an integral part of Israeli society. Many work in agriculture, particularly on kibbutzim, but also in construction, technology, medicine, and justice. But if you live in an unrecognized place, you don't have the same rights as others, says Siam, who is campaigning for Bedouin access to basic services. Well, the deadly Hamas attack has galvanized volunteers and community leaders. Quote, faced with the urgency of the situation, we committed ourselves to helping the poorest people in the community, explained Siam. Community volunteers, including a resident like Fahan Abu Riach, who spearheaded a private humanitarian initiative, transforming part of his house into a makeshift warehouse. So under bright neon lights, Riach's children are hard at work securing cardboard cartons with tape and filling the boxes with packets of flour, chickpeas, infant milk powder, and stuffed toys. The donations are varied. Quote, we want to show these people who are the most deprived in socioeconomic terms that we haven't forgotten them, said Riach. All the donations come from Jewish friends in Tel Aviv. In this arid region of southern Israel, this is not a new phenomenon. Quote, we should be united and work together to find long-term solutions and keep the peace, says Riach. Simply. Well, Odeh Samana, an energetic young man, manages the operation in this town of around 20,000 inhabitants. Quote, Hura is the logistics headquarters. Here, we're making sure that everyone gets what they need. We've set up a special team of volunteers to deal with any emergencies in the community, whether it's food, shelter, or anything else. We also make sure that information from the Israeli army, such as security announcements, are brought to everyone, he explains. The young municipal employee, a volunteer on this mission, prefers not to dwell on the horrors of the crisis that has dragged on for decades and hit his community particularly hard. Quote, we're in the middle of this horror, but I want to convey a message of coexistence and peace. Arabs, Jews, extremists on both sides want us to fight. We can still live together. I think we have to seize the opportunity of this crisis to be stronger together, says Samana. So that message of peace is also hammered home by Siam. Quote, I'm an Arab, a Muslim, an Israeli. I am heartbroken by all the violence I have seen on both sides. We must never attack women, children, those who are not involved in a conflict on either side. War is never the solution to anything. We need to talk to each other to find solutions, he said. Christians, Jews, Muslims, Druze, Circassians, people of different faiths have always coexisted in this ancient land, noted the activist. Quote, we will continue to live side by side. This is not a religious war. Only the terrorists of Hamas and Hezbollah want to destroy the state of Israel. The Palestinians, especially those in the Gaza Strip, have suffered a great deal. With each escalation of violence, their living conditions have worsened, even though they have been issued many work permits. Most Gazans want to live in peace. No one wants to grow up under bombs, he says. For the Negev Bedouin Arabs, it's impossible to pick a side between their Jewish and Palestinian brothers. Like many in the community, Siam has family and commercial ties with the Palestinians of the West Bank. The situation is different in Gaza, which is under blockade. We're not allowed to go there as Israeli Arabs, and we're attacked like any other Israeli, says Siam, noting that authorities in Israel and Gaza have never entered into negotiations, quote-unquote, despite several eruptions of violence over the past few years. For this pacifist dialogue is essential for breaking the cycle of violence. Quote, the world has looked the other way for far too long. I hope that the United States, China, Europe, everyone, tries to find a long-term solution, he says. The Palestinian people must be free in their country and obtain rights, stop fighting, and negotiate. So that's like one of the major, major issues. One second. One moment here. Now, let me just quickly look. I wanted to check some other things for you. Bear with me a moment as we move on. One second. All right, one more minute here. Sorry about that. Okay, well, it seems that the Israel-Hamas war has been defined by the Red Cross, and they have warned that the Gaza situation is dire. It seems the Red Cross advised that the lack of food, water, and electricity is impacting those displaced in Gaza. And Emmanuel Macron, the French president, decried a video of a Franco-Israeli hostage held by Hamas. So here's the latest information. Israeli airstrike killed high-ranking Hamas commander. It seems that Hamas's military branch, the Hassan Brigades, said on Tuesday that one of its top commanders, Ayman Nofal, was killed by an Israeli airstrike. Nofal is believed to be the highest-ranking militant killed by Israel in its latest military offensive towards Hamas in Gaza. Hamas said that Nofal was killed by Israeli strikes in central Gaza. Nofal was believed to be in charge of Hamas's activity in central Gaza and also helped coordinate with other groups such as the Palestinian Islamic Jihad in the enclave. Also, we find that U.S. troops are put on alert amid Mideast tensions, the Pentagon says. The United States Department of Defense on Tuesday said that about 2,000 U.S. military personnel have been put on deployment alert, quote, to respond quickly to the evolving security environment in the Middle East, end quote. Further, No decisions have been made to deploy any forces at this time, the Department of Defense, U.S. Department of Defense, had said. The Wall Street Journal reported that the troops would serve either as advisors or medical support, and the U.S. has already deployed 2 aircraft carriers in the region. While the U.S. is particularly concerned that Iran could ramp up tensions in the Middle East, with Tehran backing Hezbollah in Lebanon and providing support to Hamas in Gaza. Hezbollah in particular could ramp up its attacks on northern Israel as the Israeli military prepares for a ground incursion into Gaza. While the Israeli military operations towards Gaza are in response to the terror attacks carried by Hamas on October 7th. Now, with regard to Germany, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz landed in Israel today to show solidarity and for talks with Israeli leaders about Hamas's terror attacks. Scholz is expected to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Israeli President Isaac Herzog on the trip. The Chancellor will also meet the relatives of German hostages held by Hamas in Gaza. After visiting Israel, Scholz is scheduled to head to Egypt. Then only a few hours ago, humanitarian aid workers are at risk in Gaza, so says the Red Cross. Stephen Ryan of the International Committee on the Red Cross told Deutsche Welle, the German paper, that humanitarian aid workers are ready to help people in Gaza in any way we can. Quote, we have over 100 staff members in Gaza, and they are doing the best that they can to help the people that they can with the dwindling resources that we have, Ryan said. This means that we need to have much more relief items into Gaza as soon as possible. Ryan noted that the Red Cross is in touch with all sides of the Israeli-Hamas conflict. He said that the, quote, lives of healthcare workers and humanitarians are at risk by responding here. End quote. Further, Ryan continued, this means that in order to provide assistance, there needs to be pauses to the fighting and our teams need to be able to do their jobs. Well, Israel last week called on 1.1 million people in northern Gaza to move southward. Israel is gearing up for a ground offensive against Hamas in Gaza after the militant group carried out terror attacks on Israel on October 7. He said the situation in Gaza is dire, quote unquote, noting that restricted access to food, water, and electricity is impacting Palestinians in Gaza who have been displaced. Quote, we've seen families, women, elderly people trying to walk to safety, but none of them are sure where it's safe, Ryan had said. Right now, many people are still sleeping in the open and nobody knows what's coming next. Children are afraid, and we're seeing people in complete disarray, and right now the situation is critical, end quote. Hamas is responsible for Gaza civilians' well-being, the IDF, or Israel Defense Forces spokesperson, says. In an interview with Deutsche Welle on Tuesday, Israel Defense Forces spokesperson Libby Weiss said that Hamas is, quote, responsible for the well-being of the civilian population of the Gaza Strip. Weiss said that Hamas is the, quote, sovereign power within the Gaza Strip, and it is their prerogative to move civilians southward. Israel last week called on 1.1 million people in northern Gaza to move to the south. This comes as Israel prepares for a ground offensive against Hamas after the militant group carried out large-scale terror attacks on Israel on October 7th. We have provided that warning, end quote, Weiss said, of evacuation orders to Gazans in the north. Quote, we have been providing it for several days now, much to our operational detriment, but we are doing this because we want to minimize the impact on civilians, end quote. Weiss accused Hamas of, quote, trying to force civilians to stay, end quote, in northern Gaza. She rejected allegations that the IDF struck civilian convoys being evacuated in Gaza. The evacuation orders by Israel have been criticized, as Gazans are unable to leave the strip due to closed borders. Electricity, along with food and water, are in short supply in Gaza, with Germany and other nations urging humanitarian aid to be let into the Strip via the southern Rafah crossing with Egypt, with Turkey in contact with Hamas over hostages. It seems that the Turkey's foreign minister said today that his country is in contact with Hamas regarding hostages being held in Gaza. Quote, so far, we have received requests from various countries for the release of their citizens. As a result, we started to discuss these issues, especially with the political wing of Hamas. Turkish Foreign Minister Hakan Fidan said during a press conference on a visit to Lebanon, the Israeli military has said nearly 200 hostages are being held in Gaza. Hamas, meanwhile, has claimed 200 to 250 people are held captive. Although Turkey has strong economic ties with Israel, Turkish leaders such as President Recep Tayyip Erdogan have earlier expressed sympathies for Hamas. This means that Turkey could play a mediating role in the Israeli-Hamas conflict. Turkey does not recognize Hamas as a terror organization, unlike the United States, Germany, and other countries. Well, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians are still in northern Gaza, the IDF, or Israel Defense Forces, say. The Israeli military today or this morning provided an update on evacuation efforts in Gaza. Israel last week urged 1.1 million Palestinians in northern Gaza to move to the southern part of the territory. The evacuation comes as Israel is preparing to launch a ground offensive against Hamas in Gaza after the militant Islamist group's terror attacks on Israel on October 7. That's 7 days ago. Now, Israel's Defense Forces, the IDF, spokesperson Jonathan Conricus said that just over 600,000 people are believed to have moved to southern Gaza as of Monday evening. Quote, there are still a few hundred thousand who should leave, Conricus had continued. Conricus also spoke about evacuations within Israel itself. Residents in Israeli towns near the Gaza Strip and near Lebanon have been obliged to leave amid fears from not only Hamas, but also Hezbollah. Quote, there are about 500,000 internally displaced Israelis at this time, Conricus had said. About 5 hours ago, Macron decries Hamas's video of Franco-Israeli hostage. French President Emmanuel Macron today deplored a video from Hamas, which showed footage of a Franco-Israeli woman being held captive in Gaza. Quote, it is an ignominy take innocent people hostage and put them on show in this odious way, Macron said, as he cited, by the Elysee Palace. Macron urged the hostages' immediate and unconditional release, end quote. France said it is working towards getting its nationals released from Hamas. The mother of the Franco-Israeli hostage seen in the Hamas video urged, quote, the world to return my baby to me, end quote, according to French media. The Israeli military has confirmed that 199 hostages have been taken inside Gaza. Hamas, meanwhile, has said 200 to 250 hostages are being held. Chancellor Olaf Scholz of Germany has met Jordan's king to consult on the Israeli-Hamas conflict. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz met with Jordanian King Abdullah II in Berlin early on Tuesday before taking off for his trip to Israel. Quote, our situation is indispensable in order to forge a common understanding of the situation in the Middle East, Scholz said, in the German capital alongside the Jordanian leader. We share a common goal. We want to avoid a conflagration, a wider war in the region, end quote, Scholz said. He called on Lebanon-based Hezbollah and Iran not to intervene in the war. Scholz praised Germany's partnership with Jordan during the meeting. The chancellor also reiterated his condemnation of Hamas's terror attacks on Israel on October 7, which led to over 1,300 people dead. In addition, Scholz advocated for humanitarian access to the Gaza Strip. The enclave's supply of electricity, food, and water is deteriorating, with Palestinians there having nowhere else to go due to closed borders with Israel and Egypt. During his remarks, Abdullah lamented the loss of life in Israel and Gaza and urged to stop to violence. Quote, the threat of this war expanding is real, Abdullah had said. The cost this will bring on all of us is too much to bear. Well, King Abdullah also said that Palestinian refugees in Gaza must not be forced to go to Jordan or Egypt. Quote, that is a red line because I think that it is a plan by certain of the usual suspects to try and create de facto issues on the ground, Abdullah had said. No refugees in Jordan, no refugees in Egypt, end quote. Quote, this is a situation that has to be handled within Gaza and the West Bank, Abdullah said, and you don't have to carry this out on the shoulders of others, end quote. Israel says it stopped its attempted infiltration from the Lebanese border. The Israeli Defense Force, the IDF, said today that it prevented an infiltration of Lebanese militants seeking to enter Israel from neighboring Lebanon. A short while ago, IDF observation troops spotted a terrorist squad attempting to infiltrate the security fence with Lebanon and plant an explosive device, the IDF said. The IDF said it killed four terrorists, quote unquote, when stopping the infiltration. Well, tensions have ramped up in recent days between Israel and Hezbollah. Hezbollah is an Iran-backed Shiite political organization and paramilitary group based in Lebanon. Well, the United States, Germany, and several Sunni Arab countries deem Hezbollah to be a terrorist organization, while the European Union considers Hezbollah's armed force or armed wing as a terrorist group. Scholz and Biden plan a back-to-back trip to Israel. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz is set to visit Israel today, becoming the first head of state to visit the nation since the October 7 Hamas terror attacks claimed more than 1,400 Israeli civilians and troops. Scholz said it was important to express my solidarity with Israel very practically with my visit, as the visit will be the strongest message yet about the German government's commitment to stand with Israel, end quote. The German leader told reporters the agenda included discussions on, quote, concrete practical issues with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel's war cabinet. Other topics include the reorganization of humanitarian aid to Gaza and steps to minimize the conflict from spilling into other arenas like along the Israel-Lebanon border. U.S. President Biden is also set to visit Israel the following day. Biden's visit was announced by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken early on Tuesday following extensive talks with Netanyahu and Israel and Israel's war cabinet. Biden will, quote, reaffirm United States solidarity with Israel and our ironclad commitment to its security, end quote, Blinken told reporters after the meeting. Kirby said that Biden will meet with Jordanian King Abdullah, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, and Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas in Jordan following talks in Israel. Well, the United States and Israel agree on aid plan for civilians in Gaza, Blinken says. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said he agreed with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to, quote, develop a plan, end quote, to enable humanitarian aid to reach civilians in Gaza. Quote, today, and at our request, the United States and Israel have agreed to develop a plan that will enable humanitarian aid from donor nations and multilateral organizations to reach civilians in Gaza, Blinken told reporters. Quote, if Hamas in any way blocks humanitarian assistance from reaching civilians, including by seizing the aid itself, we'll be the first to condemn it, and we will work to prevent it from happening again, Blinken said. A timeline for implementing the plan was not announced. The United Nations has warned of a humanitarian crisis in Gaza is running out of drinking water, food, diesel, and medical supplies. Since Gaza-based Hamas militants carried out terrorist attacks killing 1,300 Israeli civilians, Israel has responded with a massive bombing campaign while enforcing a total blockade of the Palestinian enclave. Israeli retaliatory strikes have killed at least 2,778 Palestinians, health officials in the blockaded enclave say. And Blinken was in talks for more than 6 hours with Israel's war cabinet on Monday evening, and the meeting extending beyond midnight in Israel. A White House National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby said, quote, "We've been crystal clear about the need for humanitarian aid to be able to continue to flow into Gaza, and that has been a consistent call by President Biden and certainly by this entire administration." Well, humanitarian aid remains stuck at the Rafah border crossing. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, renewed calls to open the Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egypt, which is the only viable way for humanitarian aid to enter the Gaza Strip. Well, the Egyptian government had stated on Monday that the Rafah crossing was not officially closed, but had become inoperable due to Israeli retaliatory airstrikes on Hamas militants in Gaza. In a report released on Monday, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs and the United Nations Office for the Coordination emphasized that the siege of Gaza is ongoing. The Rafah crossing has remained closed, preventing the entry of desperately needed humanitarian aid, including food, water, and medicine, awaiting on the Egyptian side, it said. Gaza has been under full electricity blackout for the sixth consecutive day, it said, adding that hospitals were on the brink of collapse. Authorities in Gaza said there was a very severe shortage of water. Citizens were forced to drink unsuitable water, they said, warning of, quote, a dangerous health crisis that threatens citizens' lives. Well, Israel announced a total blockade on the entry of food, water, and diesel, as well as the cutting of electricity to Gaza after the Hamas terror attacks on October 7. The United Nations Security Council rejects a Russian resolution on Gaza. Seems that the United Nations Security Council rejected a Russian resolution that condemned violence and terrorism against civilians, but made no mention of Hamas. Hamas, considered a terrorist group by the European Union, United States, Germany, Israel, and others, carried out a wide-scale attack against Israel after breaching border defenses on October 7. The terror attack, which killed more than 1,400 Israeli civilians and troops, was the worst Jewish massacre since the World War II Nazi Holocaust. Only four countries joined Russia in voting for the resolution: China, United Arab Emirates, UAE, Mozambique, and Gabon. Four countries voted against it: the United States, Britain, France, and Japan. The other six countries abstained. For a resolution to be adopted, it needs a minimum of 9 yes votes in the 15-member council. The United Kingdom ambassador to the United Nations, Barbara Woodward, said it would be unconscionable, quote, unconscionable for this council to ignore the largest terror attack in Israel's history. Now let's quickly look at some other issues. Bear with me a moment, 1 second. Sorry, bear with me a moment here. 7 seconds. Let me just see if we have all this here in place. Yeah, this is really quite important on a completely different issue. And this refers to China. The Belt and Road concept. The question is, just how successful is ruler Xi's Chinese dream? Seems China's Belt and Road Initiative stands as one of Xi Jinping's most iconic policies. However, sustaining the same fervor it once enjoyed seems to present more challenges now than ever before. China's hosting its third Belt and Road Summit this week, marking the 10th anniversary of its iconic Belt and Road Initiative, the BRI. Worldwide leaders and representatives from over 100 countries are gathering in Beijing, including Russian President Vladimir Putin. Putin is keen on intensifying relations with China and showing that he is not isolated internationally. Russia expert at the University of Leipzig, which is in Germany, Alexei Shigadaev, advised. Well, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov will also be present at as Chinese President Xi Jinping heralds a milestone for his, quote, Chinese dream, end quote. In 2013, shortly after becoming president, Xi Jinping proposed the ambitious concept of a One Belt, One Road policy, which has since been recognized as the core of China's major country diplomacy, quote unquote, and an essential strategy for realizing the Chinese dream, quote unquote. 10 years on the BRI has expanded to Europe, Asia, Africa, and Latin America, far exceeding the scale of the ancient Silk Road, but it seems to be facing more challenges than ever before. According to Germany's strategy on China, Beijing's political initiatives, such as the BRI, provide the framework for China's political and geoeconomic relations on all continents. For example, in some countries, infrastructure loans have contributed to unsustainable debt levels and created strong political dependencies. According to official Chinese data, as of June 2023, China has signed over 200 Belt and Road Cooperation Agreements with 152 countries and 32 international organizations. The BRI has exceeded $1 trillion in cumulative participation since its inception in 2013, according to the Green Finance and Development Center at Fudan University. Xian Fushen, Executive Director of the Belt and Road Research Center at Tongkang University in Taiwan, advised that the Xi Jinping administration achieving the, quote, Chinese dream, end quote, through the BRI is not only about gaining real power, but also about balancing against the West. And from this perspective, he believes the initiative is largely successful, quote, unquote. The BRI has now reached Africa, Central America, and even Southeast Asia. It has also extended to the South Pacific Islands beyond the so-called Second Island Chain. It is constantly evolving with international situations and China's friendly relations. The BRI has transformed from early stage infrastructure construction to energy control and has become an important strategic military outpost. China hopes to push its diplomats, military, and political influence outward through national efforts, according to Shen. Yun Sun, the co-director of the East Asia Program and director of the China Program at the Stimson Center, advised, quote, one piece of the China dream is China helping the less developed countries to grow. And some would say China did achieve that, end quote. In October, Indonesia's Jakarta-Bandung high-speed railway just opened. This flagship project is built by a joint venture of Chinese and Indonesian state-owned enterprises. China provides part of the funding through loans. The railway is the first high-speed railway in Southeast Asia and China's first overseas high-speed rail project, raising hopes of boosting economic developments and attracting investment for the Indonesian government. But are there many failures? However, this does not mean that the BRI has not faced setbacks. China recently released a white paper on the BRI stating that from 2013 to 2022, direct investment in co-building countries exceeded $240 billion and, quote, not a single country has fallen into a debt crisis due to participating in Belt and Road cooperation, end quote. Zhang Fuxian advised, however, that this white paper, quote, underestimates, end quote, the debt deficit part and does not reflect the real situation. In the past decade, China has become the largest creditor for many developing countries. The West has criticized China for conducting debt trap diplomacy, quote, unquote, through the BRI. One of the most common examples is Sri Lanka, which declared bankruptcy in 2022. China is Sri Lanka's largest creditor, accounting for about 52% of its total debt, approximately $7.3 billion, and Sri Lanka borrowed from China to build the Hambantota port, but could not repay the debt. In 2017, the deep water port was leased to China for 99 years. Sri Lankan President Ranil Wickremesinghe will also attend the third BRI forum and meet with Xi Jinping. Sri Lanka aside, many other countries are facing similar risk challenges. Taking the Jakarta-Bandung high-speed railway in Indonesia as an example again, the final budget for the project has significantly exceeded the original estimate of about $5.5 billion and has risen to over $7 billion, experiencing severe cost overruns. And some are concerned that Indonesia may face a debt trap in the future and China may not be able to recover its debt. Ian Chong, the associate professor at the Department of Political Science at the National University of Singapore, said, quote, in the future, China will be more cautious in terms of risk management, end quote, Chong had explained. Well, the debt issues of these planned projects will still exist. China will try to handle them, but the question is how much can it handle? In the future, it may choose projects with lower risk or higher returns to avoid the label of the debt trap being revived, end quote. However, estimating to what extent the debt trap narrative will impact the BRI is still difficult. Yun Sun, a China's expert at the Stimson Center, advised, quote, BRI will not be derailed. The more than 100 countries going to Beijing for the BRI forum is a testament to how the majority of countries in the world do not want to anger China, even if Italy pulls out. Italy is the only G7 country that has joined the BRI. In recent months, the country has questioned the effectiveness of the BRI, saying that it has not truly benefited Italy, leading to the intention to withdraw. So can China continue spending big? China's weakening economy also challenges the Belt and Road Initiative. According to the latest data from the Green Finance and Development Center at Fudan University, for construction projects, the deal size in the first half of 2023 was the lowest since the BRI was announced in 2013. A paper released last month by Boston University Global Development Policy Center, GCI, pointed out that China's lending in Africa in 2021 and 2022 was below $2 billion, the lowest in 20 years. Quote, if China economic development does not have any sudden breakthrough, this way of spending big cannot be sustained, as stated Ian Chang, end quote. Xian Fu Shen, the director of the Belt and Road Research Center at Tongkang University in Taiwan, also pointed out that when China's economy begins to decline, there may be a major review of the BRI internally. Quote, China's economy is in trouble, but you are still spending big. So this is an internal conflict and struggle, Shen advised, adding that Chinese people may question whether the big spending Belt and Road projects from the past should continue. So the question is, well, what lies ahead? Many observers have pointed out that the BRI is moving away from the big money spent on major infrastructure. Observing the latest Belt and Road white paper, Shen said that China will emphasize the so-called high-quality Belt and Road projects in the future instead of spending big. In addition to developing the digital Silk Road in e-commerce, investment projects must also have returns. According to Shen, this may include, quote, letting China exploit your minerals, control your rare resources, or having special military value. As the BRI faces increasing external security scrutiny, President Xi has recently proposed several concepts that have attracted attention, such as the Global Development Initiative, Global Security Initiative, and Global Civilization Initiative. Some believe that these three global initiatives may replace the BRI as the core of China's diplomatic framework over the next decade. Yun Sun, a China expert at the Stimson Center, also believes that as these, quote, global initiatives, end quote, become new focal points, international attention on the BRI has increased significantly. It is natural for the BRI to morph to its next stage, but it will not be easily stopped. That's for sure. So we have to see where all that goes. 1 second here. Bear with me a moment here. All right. 1 second. 1 minute here. All right, I want to cover some other things with you, so bear with me a moment. This is pretty frightening, but it's happening. So it needs to be reported. The killer of a French school teacher claims the attack for the Islamic State group. The man who killed a French school teacher last week said he was acting for the Islamic State group in a video recorded before the attack, a source close to the case said today. Mahmoud Mugushkov, 20, also made a very marginal quote-unquote reference to the October 7 attack by Hamas on Israel in the video before knifing the teacher to death at a school in Arras in northern France on Friday, the source said. Mugushkov, a Russian from the mainly Muslim northern Caucasus region, was due to appear before an investigating magistrate late Tuesday to be charged. The attack came almost 3 years to the day after a similar killing of a teacher near Paris, which shocked the public and triggered a massive security response. Well, France again raised its security level after Friday's attack, deploying 7,000 troops. Adding to the tension, the school in the town of Arras was evacuated Monday after a bomb threat, which proved to be a false alarm. Following the shooting in Brussels of two Swedes by a Tunisian man, also claiming inspiration from Islamist Emmanuel Macron, said Tuesday that, quote, all European states are vulnerable. There is a return of this Islamist terrorism, end quote. Continuing, he said, we all have a vulnerability. It's what comes with being a democracy, a rule of law state, where there are individuals who can decide at a given moment to commit the worst acts, end quote, McClellan told reporters in the Albanian capital of Tirana. He nevertheless added that he had seen, quote, no failures, end quote, by French security services ahead of the stabbing in Arras. At home, McClellan has told ministers to, quote, embody a state that is ruthless towards all those who harbor hate and terrorist ideologies, end quote. He wrote that schools would remain a bulwark, quote, unquote, against extremism and a, quote, sanctuary for our pupils and everyone who works there, in a Monday post on X. So most people know it as Twitter still. Macron's office said he would attend the funeral of the victim, 57-year-old Dominique Bernard, on Thursday. The murder has intensified nervousness in France, which has a large Muslim and Jewish population and has been on the alert for violence since Hamas's attack on Israel. Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin said on Monday that 100 people had been arrested for anti-Semitic acts or expressing support for terrorism since the October 7 assault. Bernard was killed almost 3 years to the day after teacher Samuel Paty was beheaded outside his school in a Paris suburb on October 16th of 2020. The families of Paty's and the suspected Arras assailant both hail from Russia's North Caucasus region. Mogushkov was born in the Republic of Ingushetia and reportedly arrived in France at the age of 5. He was already on a French national register as a potential security threat and under surveillance by France's domestic intelligence agency, the DGSI. His father, who was also on the list, was deported back in 2018. Macron has called on police to comb through their files of radicalized people who could be deported. Darmanin said that 193 such cases would be re-examined. Macron has told Darmanin to focus especially on young men between the ages of 16 and 25 from the Caucasus, his aide said. Unbelievable. one second. So the question is, what's going to be done about this, and who knows? We'll have to see what the French decide. Unbelievable. Literally unbelievable. One second. All right, let me just quickly see what else we have here. I think we may be at the end of the road for us today. Let me just see if we missed something in the news. Well, this is really quite interesting since we're in France. There's been a 7.28 feet decline of all places in Mont Blanc. Unbelievable. And the decline could be down to even to lower precipitation during summer, says Jean de Garrett, the chief geometer in the Haute-Savoie department of southeastern France. Mont Blanc could well be much taller in 2 years when it is next measured, he said. The mountain's rocky peak measures 4,792 meters equivalent to about 3 feet. So it's like about 15,000 feet above sea level, but its thick covering of ice and snow varies in height from year to year, depending on wind and weather. So researchers have been measuring it every 2 years since 2001, hoping to garner information about the impact of climate change on the Alps. But we're gathering the data for future generations. We're not here to interpret them. We leave that up to the scientist, de Garrett had said. People shouldn't use the height measurement to say any old thing, he urged. Around 20 people scaled the mountain in mid-September to carry out measurements over several days, divided into 8 parties, equipped with high-tech tools, and for the first time, a drone. Quote, we've learned a lot from these measurements campaigns. We know that the summit constantly changing in an altitude and position with changes of up to 5 meters. It's about 15 feet, Desgarettes had said. Unbelievable. So we'll see what goes on. I see we're down to the last few minutes. So let me just thank you for being with us today, as we thank you every day that we're on, which is Monday to Friday. And we hope you'll consider reading us at on the Yonkers Tribune website, yonkerstribune.com. And that's about it. So have a great day, and thank you for being with us today. Goodbye.